This is an ABC podcast.
Hello again. Welcome to The Mindfield, the show where we try to negotiate the ethical dilemmas of modern life. I'm Scott Stevens. My co-host is Waleed Ali. Look, I mentioned if you were listening to last week's show, Waleed can't join us in the ABC studio because he made the poor judgment of traveling to New Zealand recently. He's not in quarantine already. I love New Zealand. But, you know, in terms of the logistics of our show, Waleed, it wasn't exactly the best move, was it?
Well, I would say in my defense that it was a work assignment and a very worthy one. And I will also say that New Zealand, certainly at the time, seemed much safer than Australia. I think they had 4 cases of coronavirus. And I would also say that I was back before the curfew comfortably. So this is just an ABC thing we should point out. Should we actually also come clean and tell people that I'm speaking to you from last week? Because we don't know how the coronavirus situation is going to unfold.
That's right.
And so we kind of figured it was best to try to get as many of these in the can, as they say in the industry, as possible before we
to use the insider lingo.
Yes, which means a couple of things. I think what we're about to talk about is relevant throughout the whole crisis.
Yep.
But it also means there might be specifics that we would ordinarily refer to that we're not going to, because we haven't experienced them yet, because this was recorded a week ago. So I am now at my home doing this because of the ABC protocols. It's possible that by the time this goes out, everybody's in their homes, and this would be a strange thing even to try to explain. Mm. And it would be you, Scott, who has to explain why it is that you're being so cavalier and just out and about popping into studios willy-nilly at a time of national lockdown.
So because being out and about and fundamentally being a social animal is just the kind of guy I am. That's
right.
Really,
yes, right. Even at the risk of further compromising people in a pandemic.
Let me just pick up on this point, though, Waleed. So when we're broadcasting now, a huge amount has happened in 1 week. By the time you're listening to this, a huge amount will have happened in 2 weeks. Are you surprised at just how quickly things are developing and how quickly and how stridently political leaders are responding to the situation?
Surprised. It's one of those things that is surprising to experience, but there's also nothing surprising about it when you stop and think about it for a minute, is there? I mean, this is the nature of pandemics. We are constantly told this. There was a period not very long ago where the coronavirus pandemic, even before it was declared a pandemic, was kind of funny in a way, like it was a subject of humor. You could make fun of people hoarding toilet paper or whatever, and it very quickly didn't, and it very quickly switched. And I think it's that moment, probably at the time when Australia banned mass gatherings and then a couple of days later imposed that self-isolation period of 14 days for anyone coming into the country, which New Zealand had done, I think, the day before. I think there was that period where suddenly everybody switched. And that does make sense because we are dealing with a situation that is, by its very nature, this is what pandemics are, exponential. Things happen exponentially. The further you are into it, the quicker it seems to evolve. And I think that's part of the reason that human beings find this a very difficult thing to process, right? Because that's not the way that we generally deal with it. I don't like to think this, but I do think that this is climate change on fast forward, right? There might come a time, particularly if we don't sort our response to climate change out, and we don't seem to be doing it, there will come a time where this is the kind of reality that climate change imposes upon us in one form or another. It's just that it happens very slowly. We're not used to processing things in quite this speed. So
I think if you're talking about, when you say this, I think if you mean scarcity, a degree...
I think fundamental disruption to forms of life.
Yes.
Which is kind of what we're talking about today. And interestingly, this is where we ended up, actually, at the end of last week. We could have just kept going and started this show at the end of last week, because that's really the question here, is that as our lives are disrupted in the most fundamental and especially thoroughgoing ways, what happens? And what do we make of that experience? And what of that experience do we learn from, hang on to, What do we discard? Like, I think there are really fundamental questions being asked of the way that we live. And it's going to be fascinating to see what comes out the other side of that.
Let me just pick up exactly there, because I think one of the things that living in an unusual time does is it does make you reassess those things that you believed were necessary, those things where things simply couldn't be any other way. But I think that there are other things, and here I don't know, I like to think that maybe I'm an optimist by nature, maybe not, maybe I'm just sort of, you know, dewy-eyed. But something that's, I suppose, impressed me, but also something that's terrified me. I have always said just how important I think public spaces, opportunities for public gathering, rituals like being able to touch one another and eat together and embrace one another. Those are the fundamental rituals, if you like, that physicalize, that instantiate, that give materiality to what I think is our fundamental ethical reality, which is the reality of mutual dependence, the reality of sociality itself, the fact that we are not first and foremost individuals. Paul Komisaroff, our guest last week, I thought described this incredibly well. He did it as a form of reprimand to me, but I couldn't have been happier that he did. It was glorious. So, you know, sociality is our fundamental quality. And we engage in these forms of ritual, of mutual eating. If you attend church or attend mosque or attend synagogue, we have particular forms of gathering together and mutuality and sharing sort of common bread or common cups or common spaces or common prayers. So there are all sorts of things that physicalize, that instantiate this fundamental ethical reality about us. I think one of the things that the coronavirus has done by placing this wall between us, so we can no longer, if you attend church, you no longer share the same bread or share the common cup. If you're out and about, I sometimes play sort of amateur basketball, not being able to shake hands before and after a game, you begin to realize just how much casual forms of physical contact mean to you. I mean, these are things that in a very real way you end up craving with other human beings who aren't intimates or who aren't members of your family. At exactly the same time, I feel that this leering at one another, this looking at one another with a degree of suspicion, are you displaying any forms of flu symptoms? Are you a possible carrier or super carrier? This kind of looking at one another with a degree of mutual suspicion rather than openness and reciprocity, that it feels to me is exacerbating some of our worst tendencies that predated the crisis. So I kind of feel that there are really unusual things that are happening here that make us maybe nostalgic for things that we took for granted, and at the same time are deepening tendencies that already existed towards solipsism, mutual suspicion, and competitiveness.
Yeah, which is why we get the contradictory responses, I think, that we spoke about last week, but also why people are fearful of isolation, I think. I think we're beginning to discover the extent to which, in spite of the fact that we are becoming more isolated in a way through our addiction to social media and things like that, we are still basically, and maybe it is only basically, connected at a societal level through social interactions. But that then raises the question for me that I was pointing to, right? When we get through this, we get to the other side, do we have a renewed sense of the importance of those things? Do we, for example, start to realize that it might be good to put our phones away and reclaim and recreate social space? Right, why stop there? A million other questions are being asked of us. Do we recognize, as we contemplate the incredibly trying times that lie ahead for people who are casual workers, for example, and don't have access to sick leave, and may or may not be rescued in the end by some government package or other that gets announced at some point or doesn't. Do we get to the other end of that and say, maybe this casual work thing that our economy seems so built on is a bad idea? We are right now experiencing a fundamental truth that we spend our lives covering up, which is that we are not in control of things. We are completely codependent on our environment. We are biologically grounded and situated
and inextricably vulnerable.
Linked. And that's the key point.
Yeah.
We are vulnerable. We are insecure. We live highly contingent lives, and we delude ourselves about that because we set up these great abstractions, economies, global economies, information technology, new industries that we kind of create out of nothing, new forms of trade. We do all of this. Medicine will always save us because, we, you know, pandemics are a thing of the past. Why would anybody ever imagine living through that? What a medieval existence that would be. Well, it seems hyper-modern now. And it seems hyper-modern now because, in some ways, this pandemic, the effects of it are exacerbated by the fact of globalization, by the fact that we are so globalized. And one way of understanding every response we've had to it is that we are in a process of trying to de-globalize. We're shutting borders, everyone stay home, don't travel anywhere, our trade is limited, and simple things. It becomes cheaper to let somebody else do it in another country. We experienced this with testing kits for coronavirus, where South Korea was so far ahead of us because I think they were manufacturing these test kits in ways that we weren't and we couldn't, right? So our dependencies, our very might as people, as a civilization, is built on vulnerabilities that we refuse to acknowledge. Suddenly they're manifest. And suddenly we are forced to live much simpler lives, more restricted lives, more isolated lives, and to come face to face with all of those contingencies. What happens then? I am fascinated to see eventually what forms of life we choose to discard, what we choose to adopt, what lessons we learn from the end of that. Because there are so many things being laid before us now. Do we decide to make changes on the other side? Or do we, you know, having before us all of the opportunities to return to life as it was, find it irresistible and just go straight back to all those contingencies and just over time forget all those vulnerabilities, all of those interdependencies, the importance of the social in the way that we live? I think these are the long-range questions that this pandemic's asking us.
I think you're right. Let's not underestimate. I think everything you said is right. Can we just remember, though, how adaptable and opportunistic capitalism has proven in the face of the very crises that have meant to curtail or to push back against or to limit capitalism's reach. I mean, in the face of climate crisis, for instance, there is already a massive industry called something like calamity capitalism or disaster capitalism, that will absolutely profit from this. I mean, already, I don't know about you, I'm getting emails about what to stream while I'm in isolation, what books I might like to read while in isolation. So there's no doubt that there's a kind of diabolical resilience here that could well capitalize to, you sort of use the appropriate term, to capitalize on this very stripping back to a kind of more basic form of life, a more prudential and socially vulnerable form of life. It just strikes me then that in addition to the really fundamental work that needs to be done to care for one another and to make sure that the death toll and that health is preserved as much as possible, there is a pedagogy that has to run through this, which means that the politics that runs through this cannot simply be efficient and effective. It also has to be proscriptive in the sense of what is it for our own sake? What is it for the sake of healthy societies that needs to come next? That feels like a job for a degree of democratic pedagogy, I think.
Possible, although it may be that the pandemic carries its own pedagogy in the same way that wars do.
Yes, and I think that's right.
That's kind of where I'm... Well, the direction I'm thinking anyway. This is The Minefield. You can listen to the show on RN, as you might be doing right now, but you can catch us anytime on the ABC Listen app if you like. And you can also subscribe to our podcast, which I would recommend because we find that the 25 minutes of the radio show cannot contain everything that we want to say. So we just keep going for a little while and we bring that to you via that platform. So please do subscribe. Scott.
Our guest, and look, we need to apologize for this. Our guests invariably display the most uncommon generosity to be able to schlep into some ABC studio someplace, to brave traffic, to soldier through public transport. Our guest for this week, she was willing to do that as well, but because of protocols, we've had to consign her to her office in front of her computer, and she joins us by Skype. Stephanie Collins is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Australian Catholic University. She's the author of a wonderful new book called Group Duties, Their Existence and Their Implications for Individuals, which makes Stephanie pretty much the perfect person to be speaking to today. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us on The Minefield.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really great to be here.
So look, let's seize this opportunity for a kind of moral pedagogy. What is it that this crisis has begun to reveal about our nature as moral agents, our nature as individuals, our nature as people who are exposed in a condition of mutual vulnerability?
Well, it's a really great question. I think I would want to back up and sort of critique the assumption that there's one nature that we have that's being revealed here. I think there are multiple different underlying currents within human nature, and we can draw on different of those currents in different circumstances. So obviously, one current that we're seeing quite prevalent at the moment is a kind of self-interested individualism, you know, the toilet paper crisis, the empty shelves, the suspicion that you were talking about before. But there's another current, which I think we're also starting to see in some places. So particularly if you've got social media connections in Italy, you might have seen these videos of people singing classic Italian songs on their balconies, a whole neighborhood together singing some song, each sort of isolated on their own balcony. These are people who potentially never really knew each other before, possibly lived in quite an anonymous apartment building, and yet they're getting together and approaching this thing collectively. So I think there are two sort of strands here. There's an individualist strand and the collectivist strand. My hope is that the more collective, community-minded strand will be the one that prevails.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think, in some ways that's kind of what we've been discussing over the past couple of weeks. I think what's interesting, though, even to take the Italian example, is that took a while to emerge. Hmm. There are other great examples, by the way. One of my favourite was watching some people in Spain, high up in an apartment block, play tennis from one window to another. And of course, the minute the point was lost, the ball plummeted about 20 metres or whatever it was to the ground. So there's all this sort of invention that's going on. But then at the same time, you're starting to see now accounts from people in Italy who are saying, well, this was okay for a few weeks, but now it's starting to turn. And now, you know, the mental health consequences of this are going to be very significant. That much seems obvious. But a question that's allied to this that I find interesting is, as the big pause button on life has been hit and the world has effectively just stopped, we've been forced into much simpler ways of living. And if not yet, then we will be forced into simpler ways of living. What happens if we like that? Like, what happens if we discover that there's actually something quite pleasant about all of those things slowing down? We don't want it to slow down quite so much so that we can't access just the basic things that we like in life. But if we're given that situation where we have no choice but to spend more time with our families, perhaps a little too much time with our families, what does our attitude to work become on the other end of that? Would we, for example, reimagine an economy whereby pursuing economic growth at all costs becomes a little less appealing? 4-day weeks become the norm, or perhaps even less than that? In other words, what kind of, not just social assumptions, but what kind of bigger lifestyle assumptions, I suppose, might get questioned, and what might we decide to latch onto?
I mean, it's a great question. It's one that, it's kind of anybody's guess at this stage. I think you're absolutely right that the rampant focus on growth that all countries are kind of pursuing now looks like a bit of a fool's errand. What I would hope, the kinds of ways of life and ways of engaging that I would hope come out of our society, if it turns out that we kind of like the simpler way of living, would be a way of life in which, I mean, to give a simple example, we get to know our neighbours a bit better. So we're more communally embedded. We're thinking less at the kind of level of what I can get, and less at the level of kind of abstract markets and so on, and more at the kind of local level of the relations that we have to particular individuals, how those particular individuals are vulnerable and dependent on us, and what we can do to help each other.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly what we should most hope for. At exactly the same time, though, I guess I'm... I have certain sort of deep convictions about the nature of the ethical life as being something that is fundamentally socially embedded. At the same time, I guess I'm keenly aware that this is a form of life that has been relentlessly eroded, that we have been complicit in eroding, that we have only temporarily or intermittently taken responsibility for. So to the extent that people are rediscovering, I think, healthier forms of, say, limited or prudential life, forms of life that maybe aren't necessarily either mediated by forms of economic exchange or by the utility that one person presents to another person, for that steady process of erosion to be undone and something more healthy, something more ethically defensible, if you like, to come in its place, that's something that requires a great deal of intention. I mean, my cynical way, and this is because I'm cynical about social media itself, is that these various forms of sort of social singing or, you know, of playing tennis across buildings, these are then constructed as social media moments. And that when the frisson of that social media moment no longer exists, that the desire to do precisely that will no longer exist either. I guess my concern is there's a degree of pedagogy that has to happen here, and for that pedagogy that has to happen, the need, the felt need, needs to be capitalized or needs to be tapped into, but at the same time, the need also has to be laid aside so that something like the future can, in fact, be prepared for.
That sounds right to me. I mean, you're absolutely right that these videos of the singing and so on, as lovely as they are, and, you know, they make me tear up, they're undoubtedly kind of orchestrated as social media moments. That's for sure. I think the way that we could think about this going forward, to kind of steer a path between sort of slipping back into the kind of individualistic, like, Instagrammable approach to our lives and the kind of self-interested, social, sort of more anti-social, more kind of inward-focused perspective, would be to conceptualize ourselves, so I guess in our society, Australians or Australian residents, I'm from New Zealand, as acting together in a certain kind of way. So rather than thinking about, how can I kind of sell this moment on social media? And rather than thinking about my own narrow self-interest, thinking about Australia as a whole, as kind of a person, a creature, an organism. This is something that we're kind of used to doing when we think about Australia as an international actor, right? We're used to thinking about it as something that signs treaties and wages wars. Of course, when we look at that, we say, okay, so Australia performs these actions. It's this entity that acts. What is Australia? Well, it's all of us acting together in a coordinated way. And I think that kind of approach where we think about ourselves as part of this unified organic whole, of course, we still have our individuality, but we think about ourselves as embedded in this society that's cooperating together to achieve certain ends, I mean, or certain goals. At the moment, of course, it's cooperating to try and get us through this present crisis. After that, hopefully, it'll be cooperating to try and protect the most vulnerable in our society and elsewhere. I think if we can get ourselves into thinking not about me as an individual or me on social media, but rather about me as a part of this larger cooperative enterprise that is our society, then, yeah, that I hope would be a way going forward of kind of capturing the nice bits of the balcony sing-alongs, while sort of downplaying the idea that, yeah, you're doing it just to kind of get attention on social media.
The question, I suppose, becomes whether or not you can have cake and eat it in that way, whether you can just cherry pick the good bits and not the bad bits. And I suppose that's a question that's ultimately for the ages. We'll continue that, though, because that gives us a lot to talk about for the podcast element. So thank you for doing that, Stephanie. You really set it up very nicely for us. We are at the end of the radio show, though, for now. Stephanie Collins is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University, our guest for this week's Mindfield. We're done with the radio show. The podcast will continue now, and we'll see you on the radio next week. Well, we hope. Can Can we start by thinking about the social media part of this? Because yep. I've been, you know, my attitudes to social media have been viscerally negative for a very long time. They remain so, by the way. I haven't shifted on that. But it has led me to think that a lot of the things that I really detest about the modern world and contemporary forms of capitalism are going to come in quite handy over this period. That might involve food delivery services that rely on the gig economy, for example. By the way, lots of problems with that that are going to be amplified by the pandemic, but just let's focus on the availability of food delivery in that way. But things like social media. So in a period of very significant isolation, social media, people being able to, you know, video call each other or whatever it might be, may be a real salve. It might be, you know, the best and only form of communication that they have. The question then, I think, becomes, once we go through this and discover that that is absolutely no substitute for the social interactions that we have offline in the real world, will, having been through all that experience, increase our reliance upon, our addiction to things like social media, or will it help wean us off it in a way? Because we've been overdosed. We've been put in this situation where we've had to see just what it provides and just what it doesn't provide. Like, I think that's a sample question of a million questions to do with our forms of living that are going to be asked of us over the next few months.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I actually have a very different relationship to social media than you, it sounds like. I don't go on social media all that much normally, or I haven't normally, you know, not a huge amount. I have found myself on Facebook for hours a day in the last three or 4 days. It's exactly the phenomenon you're pointing to. Of course, we're more reliant on these methods of communication. But I'm not seeing that as a bad thing. You're right that it's no substitute. But I'm not sure that it's amplifying the problems that were already there with social media. I actually think it's, and this is totally anecdotal, but my experience is that social media is becoming a much more solidaristic place through this crisis. Now, of course, it will never replace face-to-face human contact. Absolutely. But perhaps social media will become a slightly less snarky, slightly less warring type place than it has been up to this point.
Well, except that it is also the place where all manner of misinformation is being spread.
That's right.
All kinds of conspiracy theories about the coronavirus are being spread. Mm-hmm. All kinds of fake solutions to it, treatments for it. Some of the stuff I've seen, and I'm not even on social media, it's just found its way to me some way or other. Some of that stuff is truly mind-blowing stuff. And then there are still, I think, politicized responses to it. You have, you know, swarms of people on social media demanding certain government action, even though the most people who are engaged in that probably wouldn't know the first thing about epidemiology. All of these sort of elements do come together. When I'm talking about amplifying the negative aspects of contemporary digital capitalism, if you like, I wasn't thinking so much about, you know, the warring nature of social media, so much as, you know, it might be that the gig economy helps us get through things by delivering, but food delivery or whatever, assuming food delivery can even still happen. But it also highlights just how bad the situation is for people who are reliant on that gig economy when they have no coverage for when their, you know, their job disappears because of the coronavirus crisis or whatever it is. That's kind of the amplification I was talking about, just to clarify.
Right. And the gig economy, this crisis is absolutely revealing their problems that always existed in the gig economy. I think I would disagree, though, that the problem is kind of capitalism itself. Perhaps that wasn't quite what you were meaning to imply. I think it's very important that capitalism is regulated, and that I think we're going to see much more of that after this is over. We're going to see much more regulation around things like, you know, Uber or Deliveroo or whatever. So actually hiring its workers and giving them the benefits that they need, the safety net that they absolutely need to ensure that they're going to be able to, you know, put food on their table and so on.
Well, are we though, Scott?
Yeah,
are you tell me this? Because
no,
I can see a world
no, we're
in
not.
Which we go to the-
so let me... yeah, I've taken all I can stand. I can't stand no more. Look, I think, to some extent, you're right that some of the forms of technological mediation we've seen are, if you like, placeholders or a kind of ersatz sociality, or if you like, sociality without the friction. That's the way that it's functioned in the past, where we can present ourselves to one another in our best possible selves and with greatest possible convenience and without the encumbrances of physicality, of smell, of touch, of all those sorts of things. I mean, I think it's probably going to happen that our reliance on digital, on that kind of digital mediation, is going to make us long a little bit more for simple, sort of old-fashioned sociality, if I can put it that way. I guess the problem is, because we still primarily think of these forms of digital commerce as under the conditions of convenience. So I use these because it's convenient, because it's cheaper, because it brings me what I need when I need it, and in the at a price that is more attractive to me. We fail to see that virtually all social relations take place as a form of gift giving. We don't simply get what we want and pay as little as possible for it. We're supposed to pay more than what we need to pay. And that excess, that gratuity, is the thing that makes those forms of social exchange really just. So, I mean, what I would hope, for instance, that these forms of social technology, and can I just also point out to all three of us that even when we're talking about these forms of kind of digital technology, you know, there are those who are going to be worst affected by the coronavirus, for whom these options are not options at all. So if we are talking about forms of sociality that we might discover, new forms of life that we might come to reinvent, let's hope that, you know, something like, you know, sort of food delivery services or various forms of sort of digitally reaching out to other people aren't simply centripetal, that they aren't simply bringing things into my orbit, but they may well become forms of technology whereby we gift give to others that are habitually, that are consistently, structurally, systemically left outside these forms of exchange. My fear, my great fear, is that because so many of our forms of interaction are simply matters of convenience and are matters of great efficiency, or are judged by us as worthwhile because of their efficiency, that when the opportunity, if we don't learn different habits in these conditions, that when the opportunity returns for these things to simply be brought back into our orbit, we're just going to fall back into those old, old forms of mutual exploitation.
But also that the arguments that have traditionally been run for the necessity of those things could arguably become stronger, right? So whatever happens by the end of this crisis, we know there's going to be serious economic damage done.
Yeah.
To take Australia as its own example, they're talking about budget deficits around the $100 billion mark, which is enormous. I'm not going to say that it necessarily will be a recession, but it's very hard to imagine that you escape a recession, right? All of these sorts of things will happen. Now, in the aftermath of that, what does the argument look like? Does it look like us saying, well, we now have discovered all of these unjust contingencies that exist within our economic system and the fragility of it, we need to think about building a different one? Or do companies say, have you seen the financial hit we've just taken? If you're going to tell us that we can no longer rely on contract or casual labour because you want people to have better sick leave or more rights, you're effectively killing any recovery. There is no way that we can rebuild. We've nearly been driven to the wall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I can see strong arguments for how you will seek business as usual, or the status quo, to be restarted, if you like, to be continued, or completely disrupted. And it will be fascinating to see which ones of those win. And I don't know really even how you would go about making that prediction.
Yeah, look, Steffi, let me give you the final word, but can I just point out on this that what I think part of what the coronavirus has in fact done, in this, to the degree that it's revealed the vulnerability of many of these casual or no contract workers on which we rely, is that what this crisis has done is it's removed from us our ability to claim that we are not responsible or that we're not complicit in the very conditions under which these workers are kept. In other words, what the coronavirus pandemic has done is it's taken away from us the ability to claim an alibi, that we just didn't know, or that we aren't responsible.
I would agree 100% with that. I think, you know, in recent years, many people have shirked their civic obligations around things like fake news, which, you know, we mentioned earlier, you know, not following up your sources when you post things online, that kind of stuff. And yeah, I think our shirking of that obligation is part of what's led to the situation we now find ourselves in.
Is a response
in terms of gig workers being unprotected, not in terms of the virus itself, in terms of gig workers and someone being unprotected.
I understand that. Yeah, although I think it's more than just that sort of fake news type element, isn't it? I mean, it's really that's an economic and political project of many decades, really, that's led to that point. But here's the thing, right? We're trying to think about what responses to this might look like on the other side of the pandemic. But what we could potentially look for historic precedents, right? How did communities respond in the aftermath of, you know, either of the world wars or whatever, you know? But we're doing this in a different environment now, aren't we? Whereby if our main mode of interaction is going to be mediated through social media, so digitized, and also, I mean, it still will remain no matter what we do, unless everybody starts watching free-to-air television again or something like that. It's still going to remain highly curated and individual, the experience that we have, right? Is the information landscape, and by virtue of that, the social landscape that we inhabit now, so fractured, so individualized, so inimical to consensus, that any response on the other side is going to necessarily be as dysfunctional as we've found politics previously? In other words, we don't have the mechanisms available to us anymore to come together, find a consensus, and then construct a response. And no crisis, even one this big, changes that fundamental underlying tectonic plate. I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly a concern that I would have. I mean, what do you think? What's going to happen there?
Well, maybe I'm more optimistic than you, and I want to say it's up to us whether the positive or the negative, kind of whether we come together to discover new ways of life as a whole society, or whether we become more fractured and individualized. I'm not entirely up to us. Of course, our world is structured in ways we can't control, but we do have some control over it.
But forms of life that aren't necessarily predicated on exchange and commercial relationships, forms of life that can't be based on massive national productive capacities in an era of climate catastrophe. So, I mean, these are the imaginative work that needs to be done here. I'm a naturally optimistic person, but this isn't going to happen by accident. This is going to happen on purpose, and it's going to happen on purpose only if we do things like massively reinvest in the humanities and the arts and in programs like moral philosophy at universities, for instance. This is not, and in primary and secondary school. So I just feel that, I mean, this is all right, and you're right, it's up to us, but it's not going to be spontaneous. It's not going to be grassroots. It's going to have to be something we commit ourselves to.
And you're calling for this in an environment of what, post-recession potentially?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
Oh yeah, it's a huge ask. It's a massive ask. And it's going to be both top-down and bottom-up.
Yes,
right?
I think that's right.
Grassroots and also government led by stimulus packages and so on, as you're suggesting. It's going to be all hands on deck.
A completely renovated welfare state. I mean, there's no way of seeing through the other side without a reconceptualization of the welfare state and possibly even something like universal basic income.
I absolutely agree with that, yeah.
There's another show, Waleed. It's Offstage. That brings us to the end. Stephanie Collins, thank you so much for joining us on The Mindfield. That was wonderful.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really great to talk.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.